Hello, everyone. Welcome to Talking Logistics, where we have conversations with thought leaders and newsmakers in the supply chain logistics industry. It's my great pleasure to welcome today's program Jackson Wood, who's Director of Industry Strategy, Global Trade Intelligence at Descartes. And today we're going to talk about five practical and effective ways to mitigate tariff impacts. So 2025 has been a roller coaster ride for supply chain and global trade executives. And it's not just that, new tariffs have been implemented on U.S. imports from just about every country in the world. It's that these tariffs keep changing, and sometimes within just a few days of them being implemented. So all of this back and forth change is adding risk and complexity to what has always been a risky and complex process. So the question many supply chain executives are asking is, how can we navigate the global trade environment to mitigate the impact of tariffs? So that is the main question we're going to address in today's episode. And it's great to have Jackson on the program to share his insights and advice on this topic. So Jackson, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Adrian. Great to be back with you.
I think we're all familiar, and I think it's actually a curse with of the saying, may you live in interesting times. And I think
Indeed.
that that is certainly true in the global trade environment, isn't it?
It absolutely is. I mean, one of the things that I think is an important reminder, in as much as all of this has quote unquote caught us by surprise, and the collective us, business leaders, subject matter experts, et cetera, is President Trump was very clear on the election campaign that this was going to happen. And I think whether it was this sort of collective delusion or a desire to just not face what this reality might be, we're all reacting with this sort of sense of shock and surprise. And like I said, he laid out everything that he was going to do and has done it. And so to your point in your opening remarks around how things need keep changing and day to day, hour to hour, I think one of the really important things we all have to come to terms with is we're just at the beginning of what could be an incredibly dynamic and challenging 4 years. And we really do need to ground ourselves in it's not a mystery, some of these things. The president has been talking about them for months or years. Some of his rhetoric around tariffs goes back to the 80s and the 90s, frankly, and trade deficits have been long-term something that he has been a vocal critic of. So I think we need to buckle ourselves in for a potentially long and maybe even scary ride over the next 4 years.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I remember, we did surveys going back to before the election, talking about tariffs because that was, the hot topic in during the presidential, election cycle. So from that standpoint, it shouldn't be a surprise. I think what has thrown people for a surprise or in a loop is the fact that it's been so dynamic, right? So it's not like, okay, we're going to implement these tariffs, and now these are the new operating rules. Let's figure out what to do. Is that okay? Here are the new operating rules, and then 3 days later, okay, we're going to change it up again. And I think that's just creating a lot of confusion, or people just waiting to
Absolutely.
see when is it truly going to solidify. All right, well, let's start by answering the question suggested by the title of the episode, and that is what are some practical and effective supply chain changes that business leaders should consider to help mitigate the impact of tariffs.
Sure. So I think I'll just start with perhaps just sort of creating a little bit of a distinction between organizations who perhaps in the past have been, very sort of limited impact with respect to tariffs and trade controls, and organizations who have been, whether the size and scale of the business, complexity of their products and services, who, have built some capability and some capacity with respect to navigating global trade. So for those organizations who are at the sort of more immature end of the spectrum, some of the things that we're going to talk about are very practical, but will require a degree of learning and ramp up with respect to internal skills and capacity. And on the other end of the spectrum, some of these things will be perhaps at least notionally understood within the organization, but perhaps not something that was ever a critical enough priority because the impacts of tariffs were frankly not substantive enough to compel us to look into some of these things. So I just wanted to make that distinction at the outset, Adrian, simply because I didn't want someone who, may be running an e-commerce business or who may be running a small manufacturing concern to hear some of these things and say, oh, okay, well, I'll just open a foreign trade zone. There's more to it than that. So with that caveat, let's sort of map these things out. So the first practical thing that organizations can do is tariff engineering. And tariff engineering has a little bit of a negative historical context because the implication can sometimes be that organizations are taking a less than honest look at how their products are classified from a tariff perspective. But that's not really what we're talking about here. And we'll get into the details of this further as we go through the conversation. But so tariff engineering's the first thing that an organization can consider. The second is free trade agreements. I think most of us are familiar with the United States, Mexico, Canada free trade agreement. That's the sort of most prominent one for us here in North America. But there are dozens of other free trade agreements that exist between countries around the world. The next are duty drawback programs. And we've got, as I mentioned, foreign trade zones. And then finally, and this is again a bit of an obscure one, but it's one that we're certainly hearing more and more organizations exploring, is the first sale rule. So I'll stop there because I know we'll have some opportunity to speak about these in more detail, but that's sort of our sort of platform for discussion here today.
Yeah, and I think that you made some great point there. You made a great point there at the onset. I mean, I think a lot of these things, all these things that you talked about, I mean, they're not necessarily new. I mean, they've been around for a long time, and some companies have been using them depending on the scale and scope of their supply chains and how complex they are and all that. And then there are other companies where, as you said, because they maybe only imported from Mexico or their scale just it just didn't make sense. They didn't reach that critical level, if you will, that critical mass, if you will, to do some of these things. But now, considering all these changes, it might be worthwhile, taking a look at some of these strategies that we're going to talk about. And then I guess the third piece that you really brought up is that, there's a lot to it that we're going to cover here in just this episode. And that's why a lot of times, a lot of companies, particularly the smaller ones that don't have that internal expertise, end up working with customs brokers and freight forwarders and partners such as yourselves that, can bring not just the technology, but, the human IP to help navigate, what again is a complex and risky,
Absolutely.
processes here. Okay, so let's dive into kind of these approaches that you outlined there, and let's start with tariff engineering. I mean, I guess to kind of set the baseline, I mean, what is it for those that are not familiar with what that terminology means, and how can it ultimately lessen the effect of tariff increases?
Sure. So I think the most important concept to sort of internalize around this notion of tariff engineering is that it doesn't necessarily apply to all types of importers, right? So if you're an importer who's just buying finished goods from a distributor or direct from a manufacturer in China or some other country, it's a little bit more difficult to get into the mechanics of how those goods are manufactured, where inputs are sourced from, where certain steps in the creation journey of that product happen. But essentially what tariff engineering represents is an opportunity for an organization that perhaps has a manufacturing footprint in several different jurisdictions, and they are ultimately going to be importing finished goods that they are either directly manufacturing or partnered with a manufacturer, and they're going to bring those finished goods into the United States. And the example that I always use when I talk about this is apparel, and particularly shirts like I'm wearing today, like you're wearing today. In a lot of instances, will go through quite a varied global journey to ultimately become the item that is brought into the United States and then sold to consumers. And so perhaps the main fabric pieces of the shirt are originally sewn together in Bangladesh. But because bringing a fully finished shirt from Bangladesh into the United States would have a prohibitively high tariff rate, Well, that initial shirt product is then shipped to Vietnam, where the buttons are affixed. And then from there, it's moved to Indonesia, where the collars are sewn on. And essentially, that is a way to take advantage of tariff codes applying to pieces of fabric that are at different stages of their manufacturing journey. And so, tariff engineering is a way to look at the inputs of products that are being manufactured and say, hey, is there perhaps an opportunity to move these products at different stages of their manufacturing journey to minimize the impact of tariffs? Now, as I mentioned, this is a very viable strategy for organizations that are manufacturing their goods or have a partnership with a manufacturer. But it's essentially utilizing not only the way that the rules are constructed, but also their own internal supply chain architecture to try to mitigate the impact of the tariffs on the final good that's ultimately being brought into the importing country.
So it strikes me as you were kind of describing that example that, just to get maybe a little bit technical, I don't want to get too deep into the weeds, but there's, HTS codes associated with each stage of that, that journey. And you have to have really a good understanding of the data and the trade. The import and export customs of individual countries, right? To say, okay, as it goes from Bangladesh to Vietnam, maybe it's duty free there because they've got a certain partnership. And then as it goes from Vietnam to somewhere else to put the buttons, so really, I mean, I think, at a high level, it's really understanding, HTS codes and how, as that shirt progresses, that HTS code changes. And then it's understanding again, all of the data that's associated and customs policies through all the countries that, are in that distributed supply chain, right?
Yep, absolutely. And you touch on a really important thing, which is that having the internal capability and capacity to even understand how your products are being classified is sort of table stakes in many of the things that we're talking about here today, right? So again, if you're a small, medium-sized business who has typically outsourced all of this to a customs broker or freight forwarder or some other trade chain partner, this is a conversation to be having with your partners in those areas to see if this might be something to explore. The other option is to say, hey, we don't think this tariff viability or volatility is going away. We think it's going to become a core competence for our business to be successful in the future. We're probably going to need to hire up some people who have a background and experience in this area to help us bring that internal skill to the level it needs to be. So again, this is a sophisticated and professional undertaking that requires sophisticated and professional skills to execute.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that example is a perfect one. So you mentioned earlier free trade agreements, right? So in the aftermath of the so-called Liberation Day tariffs, I mean, there's a lot of confusions and questions, particularly here in the States as well as Mexico and Canada, around how all of this was going to impact the existing trade agreement between the three countries, USMCA. I mean, can companies still leverage free trade agreements to help, again, eliminate or reduce tariffs and duties on imports?
Absolutely. And I think just before we speak to that, Adrian, just one thing that I want to sort of underline here, because it's essential, especially again, if you're sort of new to this area, there's a big difference between what the president says in a Truth Social post or at a press conference in the White House Rose Garden and what gets implemented as trade policy, either by the Customs and Border Protection, the Department of Commerce, the Department of State, et cetera. And so I think one of the things that people are confused by is the rhetoric that we hear from political leadership is confusing. It's like, so, Canada and Mexico are going to have all of these tariffs, but what about USMCA? Like, I thought that was the whole reason why USMCA existed. And so once you get to guidance that comes from Customs and Border Protection, you actually start to see things like, well, If the goods are compliant with the USMCA, then they will continue to be able to enter the commerce of the United States without some of these punitive tariffs in place. Now, the president didn't say that because the president is trying to establish a political posture about standing up for America first, et cetera. But where the rubber meets the road and these regulations are implemented is where we start to learn, okay, so some of the paradigms that we had coming into this new administration are in fact still valid, and trade agreements are one of them. So the concept of trade agreements, as you say, is pretty straightforward. It's countries agreeing that, hey, we want our trade to be as unencumbered and as cost-effective as possible, whether that's with one nation or whether that's with a number of nations, such as the case as with USMCA. However, the challenge of trade agreements is that it's not a zero-cost benefit. To be able to meet the compliance regulations that spell out, hey, if you are going to be building this truck in Oshawa in Ontario, Canada, and selling it into the United States, there are very specific conditions that need to be met for that tariff-free entry to actually be viable. And so that means record keeping, that means very clear instrumentation in your relationship with vendors, suppliers, et cetera. It means being able to address questions that may come from CBP around the validity of your claim to qualify under USMCA. And so, in a lot of instances, and this is now sort of moving away from the purview of USMCA in particular, but organizations have been aware of trade agreements between the United States and other countries, but have looked at those and said, look, the burden is too high. The tariff levels are low. We're not really dealing with a lot of added cost here. So we don't necessarily have a business case for hiring someone or paying someone to help us figure out how to do this in a compliant way, to build the infrastructure and the tooling necessary to meet our reporting requirements, et cetera. However, in a more burdensome tariff environment, the investment in the infrastructure necessary to leverage a trade agreement in a compliant fashion can make sense because it's going to help you take a significant chunk out of the impact that the tariffs may be having. So, to answer your question perhaps a bit more succinctly, yes, trade agreements are still a viable option. It's just a question of the business case of an organization saying, hey, there's likely going to be a little bit of capital we have to deploy to be able to do this effectively, but we think that that's going to make a substantial benefit for us in terms of mitigating the tariff impact. So that's something that we should do.
Yeah, that's a great point, and you know it makes sense. I mean, obviously, if the tariff before was 0 or 1%, you know, it was arguably significantly less expensive, right, to just pay the duty and bring it in, or it's 0, so not an issue. Versus now, what if it's 10%, 25%, 40%, right? And now you can justify, to your point, you know, putting in the internal resources, putting in the technology, or you know, working with a third party to on your behalf to do that for you, to be able to take advantage of a free trade agreement. But to your point, it's right that there's always been a cost associated with complying with the free trade agreement. You know, even with just USMCA, you know, having the bill of materials and understanding all the origin, you know, countries of origin around the bill of materials, and having all that paperwork and the calculations that you have to do to comply with the country rules of origin and so forth. I mean, there is a, you know, labor and cost and technology and all that that's kind of bundled as part of that to take advantage of that free trade agreement. So I guess the bottom line is that, yes, you know, to kind of paraphrase what you just said, is that, you know, we may be at a point, depending on how these tariffs land, that the cost of not taking advantage of a free trade agreement might be greater than the cost of putting in the systems and the people and so forth, you know, to take advantage of them. So it might be worth taking a second look on a case-by-case basis. So let's move on
Absolutely.
to a couple of the other things you talked about. You talked about duty drawback programs and free trade zones, which again have existed, for a long time. But again, many importers, for various reasons, haven't leveraged them in the past because, again, they probably didn't reach that level of that critical mass or the criteria to really make where it made sense. So, I mean, how can these things help to counteract the financial impact of tariffs or help companies to, defer, reduce, or even, eliminate tariffs?
Sure. So taking them in order, and again at a very high level. So think of the duty drawback program in the United States is essentially a mechanism that exists that allows an importer to petition the Customs and Border Protection Organization to say, hey, look, I'll pay these duties bringing this product or these raw materials into the country, but I'm either going to re-export them or I'm going to change them in a fundamental way. And in that instance, the duties that I paid or the duties that were called for by the tariffs don't really apply because that was an input that I was bringing in to do something with. And so you can go through this recovery process that's, again, like I said, making a case, providing documentation, and ultimately then having a decision made by CBP to say, yeah, we agree, we'll refund the duties that you paid. Easier said than done, of course, but a very mature program, lots of expertise, lots of tools in the market that can help organizations do that. Now, the caveat on that is that some of the reciprocal tariffs and some of the 301 tariffs around steel and aluminum, the Customs and Border Protection was very explicit to say these don't apply for duty drawback, right? So I think that's just one thing to be, again, very mindful of is to make sure that, okay, this is something that could apply for duty drawback.
Right. So if you're
More
importing
inter
steel to build a car, that's not,
Yeah, exactly. Does not apply.
Okay.
So foreign trade zones, kind of a similar concept in that it's a mechanism that allows an importer into the United States to have some leeway around what the impacts from a duty outlay might be. Now, the difference with a foreign trade zone is that if you are operating a foreign trade zone, when you import products into the United States and they are destined for the foreign trade zone, there is no duty applied to them on entry into the foreign trade zone because technically, within the boundaries of the foreign trade zone, is considered not within the commerce of the United States. So even if if the products are highly dutiable, while they're inside that foreign trade zone, you don't need to outlay what the duty payments might be. So, very beneficial from a cash flow perspective. And again, the same caveat does apply. Some goods have been explicitly called out as a part of the new tariff regime to say you're not going to be able to get some of those benefits, but not all. So, the other thing that's very appealing about foreign trade zones is there's flexibility in terms of what you might do with the products once they're inside of the foreign trade zone. So, if you're going to be directly exporting, like say as an example, you buy plastic toys from Vietnam and you traditionally sold them into the United States. Well, now the tariffs on Vietnam are prohibitively high and it doesn't necessarily make financial sense to be selling them into the United States, but you have a foreign trade zone. You could import those plastic toys from Vietnam, hold them as inventory in the foreign trade zone, and then if you're able to find new customers in Europe or somewhere in Africa or Asia, South America, et cetera, and you then export those plastic toys directly from the foreign trade zone, you never would pay the US duty because those products never entered the commerce of the United States. So that's one way. The other way is through manufacturing within the foreign trade zone. So if you're importing a lot of inputs that perhaps have a very high duty rate, you then build something with those inputs, and then you are bringing that finished product into the commerce of the United States from the foreign trade zone. The duties that you would pay on the finished product in a lot of instances are going to be lower than the duties on the inputs that you imported into the foreign trade zone. And an example that I always use is a military shipbuilder in the southeast coast of the United States, their entire shipbuilding yard is a foreign trade zone. And so all the raw materials that they have to import into that foreign trade zone to build the ship, they don't pay any duty on. They only end up paying duty on the finished ship when it leaves the foreign trade zone. So, very powerful tool, not for everyone, because like everything that we're talking about here, there is overhead for it. And specifically with a foreign trade zone, there's the physical space, there's the ability to manage the inventory. And this is where our solutions come in. They're very specific and rigorous record keeping and reporting requirements necessary if you're going to operate a foreign trade zone. But I've quite frankly been surprised by the number of businesses that in the past a foreign trade zone wouldn't have made financial sense are now reaching out to us, reaching out to some of our consultant partners to say, hey, we think this could be something that might be beneficial for our organization in the future, and we want to take a fresh look at it.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. Like you said, it's a very powerful tool. Now, is this the same? I see a lot of folks talking about bonded warehouses. Is that the same thing? Or is that something different?
I mean, it's the same concept in that there's a physical space that is considered to be quote unquote outside the United States or other countries. A lot of countries operate things like bonded warehouses, but their bonded warehouses are a little bit more restrictive, and they're really just typically intended to hold inventory. You don't necessarily have the options available that a foreign trade zone presents.
Okay, great. The last one that we're going to talk about is something that I have to admit I hadn't heard about before, which is, the first sale rule. Again, what is it and what advantages does it offer U.S. importers to reduce the burden of these tariffs?
Sure. So the first sale rule is going to apply to companies who are buying from a distributor or, in sort of crude terminology, a middleman. And the regulations around first sale rule allow you to actually use for qualifying products the price that the distributor pays buying from the manufacturer as the value of the good that you would be importing into the United States. So, somewhat similar to the duty drawback program is that there is a fairly significant documentation and rigorous sort of burden of proof around taking advantage of a first sale rule. But if you are buying from distributors, it's absolutely an option that you should explore either with your customs broker or your internal trade team to say, hey, we know that we're paying a markup on these products. We don't want to be paying a tariff on the markup. And so, can we figure out a way to get our supply chain architected in a way that we're only going to pay the tariff at the absolute minimum we have to? And that's at the price that the manufacturer sold that product to the distributor at. So
So
that's the first sale.
does that mean that the importer then has visibility to what the markup is, or is there some kind of like does
This is,
this
yeah,
yeah.
this is a part of it, right? So it requires having very good relationships with your suppliers. It has, again, the ability to build paper the file, so to speak, of getting the documentation in place to be able to prove that, hey, this is what markup the distributor is paying. And I think the biggest factor for success, at least in my experience, Adrian, is this is a vendor relationship we have that is trusted, strong, and is something where, hey, we're not going to put you in a tough spot by asking questions about your margins. We're actually just trying to mitigate the impact of the tariffs on these goods that we're importing. So, really important to have a strong trust-based relationship, but then also really important to have the right level of expertise around, hey, is this going to qualify? Are we going to be able to get the documentation and the proof that we need for it to work? But again, it in an environment such as we're in where tariffs are so significant. And let's not forget, yes, there was a come down between the United States and China earlier this week, but baseline tariffs for imports into the United States from China are still 30%, which is the highest they've been in many, many decades. So yes, we're not perhaps in at the existential level that we were a week ago, but we're still at a very significant level of tariffs for goods entering the United States from China.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I mean, we covered a lot of ground, even though at the same time we really just scratched the surface on these five, strategies. I think that they're all, very powerful and very, options that companies ought to be taking a look at to see if it makes sense for, for them. I think the challenges, and maybe as a way to wrap up, I mean, considering all these options, I mean, how should companies get started? I mean, is there one approach that companies should look into first, and and how can companies leverage partners, such as Descartes for help?
So I think it begins with an honest assessment of, hey, what kind of capabilities do we have internally to even be able to wrap our heads around these things? Like, is there someone in the organization who knows what a free trade agreement is? Is there someone in the organization who can spell FTZ? I'm being a bit facetious, but I mean, it starts with, how well positioned are we from an international trade compliance perspective to explore some of these? And if the answer is, well, we don't really have anybody internally, but we have a customs broker or a freight forwarder who helps us with this, great. Let's start having those conversations. But if you're also where, well, we have, maybe we have, we're a logistics-driven organization and we have, one person who knows about global trade compliance, which is, again, not uncommon in even medium and even large-sized organizations. Well, we need to empower that person. We need to support that person with the resources and the capacity they need to give us an educated point of view on whether or not we're going to be able to do some of these things. If you've got a few people internally that can answer these types of questions and give you good advice, then the question becomes, and this is where an organization like ours can come in, is do we have the appropriate tooling in place to be able to do our tariff classifications correctly, to do the record keeping that's required for FTAs or for FTZs or for duty drawback? Do we have the ability for our internal business systems, whether that's our inventory management, our ERP, our e-commerce storefront, are we going to be able to be, effectively sharing the information necessary to conduct these types of business transactions in a compliant way? And if you're able to answer all of those questions affirmatively, then you're in a really good position to have good strategic business conversations about how some of these things might be able to help your business. So, again, just to try to summarize at the top line, do you have the right people in place? Are they supported? Do they have the bandwidth and the capacity to do this work? And finally, is the right infrastructure in place from a tooling on the actual execution front, like things like doing tariff classifications, information sharing, record keeping, et cetera. And as I said, if you've got a yes to all of those questions, then look, this isn't optimal, but I think you can navigate the uncertainty with confidence and really continue to maintain a strategic posture as you think about the future of your business.
No, great, great advice. And as you were laying out those steps there, it struck me. I mean, when I think back to kind of the COVID pandemic, you can say that, COVID put supply chain management on the map, right? And it created awareness among the general public about the role and importance of supply chain management, to everyday lives. And particularly, it elevated the role of supply chain management to the C-level, right? CEOs, CFOs became much more aware about, that critical nature of supply chain management. I think probably the only positive thing, or one of the few positive things of this whole tariff situation, is that I think it's doing a similar thing to the global trade management, global trade compliance group within organizations, that C-level executives are now realizing that, hey, as I remember many years ago, a VP of trade compliance at a very large company told me in frustration that at her company, they viewed trade compliance as just paperwork, right? It wasn't viewed as anything strategic or important or valued or anything like that. Well, this whole situation is definitely, again, putting the spotlight on this business process and making
Absolutely.
CEOs and CFOs aware that, not only is this a risky and complex part of your supply chain, and that is directly tied to, the top line and bottom line of your organization if you don't do this right. And So to that second point, if you have the people, are they supported within the organization, right? Are they investing in perhaps augmenting that team and providing them with the budget they need to invest in some of this technology is a critical, success factor here. And I think because, everybody responds, it's very reactive, right? I think now is a good time to be in this role because you might finally be getting the respect, if you will, and the attention you need from that C-level suite.
Well said.
Well, Jackson, again, always a pleasure speaking with you. You provided a wealth of information. I'm sure that if you come back here in 6 months, there'll be a lot of different changes and new things to talk about. But until then, again, thank you very much for making the time to be with us.
You're very welcome, Adrian. I appreciate the opportunity and look forward to our next conversation.
Great. I want to thank those of you that joined us. If you're watching this episode on demand or are watching it at the Descartes website and you have a question or a comment for Jackson, you can post it there and I'm sure he'll be more than happy to respond via that medium. Again, thank you for joining us and look forward to seeing you in a future episode of Talking Logistics. Have a great day.